The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive, where we dig into the sources, analyze the ideas, and ensure you walk away well informed. Today, we are immersing ourselves in one of the most dynamic and often confusing nations on Earth, modern India. Our focus is the really comprehensive analysis presented by Craig Jeffrey in his key works, including Modern India, Transformation, Contradictions, and Global Significance.
And our mission today is, I think, critical for global understanding. Mm-hmm. We need to look past the common oversimplified headlines.
Right.
We are ignoring both the overly positive story of the emerging superpower and, you know, the solely negative framing that focuses only on poverty.
It's always one or the other.
Exactly. And Jeffrey insists that to truly understand India, you have to embrace its core reality, and that reality is a nation defined by profound, sometimes bewildering paradoxes.
Okay, so let's unpack why this matters to you right now. I mean, India is a central player, a global economic and political powerhouse.
It absolutely is.
So we need to understand the fundamental tension at its heart. How did it manage to achieve this rapid ascent, this incredible influence, while simultaneously grappling with some of the world's most acute issues?
Like deep inequality, persistent poverty, complex social stratification. The list goes on.
And the real insight that Jeffrey brings here is that India's great strength lies not in spite of its deep diversity and contradictions,
but actually because of them. Its ability to hold opposing forces in tension, tradition, and modernity, democracy, and hierarchy. That's what makes it resilient.
Which brings us to the author of our source material, Craig Jeffrey. He is a distinguished professor of development geography at the University of Oxford.
And he's considered a leading global authority on contemporary South Asian studies. This isn't just someone analyzing statistics from afar.
No, not at all. What gives him such unique insight is his, well, it's a rigorous, almost unusual interdisciplinary approach.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't just look at macroeconomics or high-level politics. He combines sophisticated geographical analysis with deep, intimate anthropological fieldwork.
And we're talking over two decades of dedicated on-the-ground research across multiple states in India. Plus, he's fluent in Hindi.
That sustained personal engagement means he can provide true context. He focuses intensely on the lived reality of ordinary Indians, not just policy briefs.
He acts as a crucial bridge, you know, linking traditional Western academic theories about development to the messy, massive, authentic social transformation that's happening within India.
And central to his entire analysis is a powerful human lens, and it's captured in a concept he coined, time pass.
Time pass, literally passing the time.
Right. And it describes the deeply frustrating experience of millions of educated but underemployed young men in India. They're navigating this prolonged, uncertain transition to adulthood, just waiting for the promises of economic growth to materialize for them.
That feeling of thwarted aspiration acts like a nervous system for the whole nation. So let's dive into the books themselves. Jeffrey's Modern India is structured as a comprehensive, accessible primer.
Yeah, it's written for an international audience, policymakers, investors, business leaders, or just highly curious people like you who really need to move past the easy cliches.
And the core premise is, frankly, revolutionary for development theory.
It really is. Mm-hmm. He argues that modern India represents a wholly unique form of democratic capitalism, one that's evolving entirely within distinctly Indian cultural, social, and political contexts.
So the critical point is this firm rejection of the idea that India is just an imitation or maybe a lagging version of a Western model of modernization.
Exactly. It's not on the same path, just a few steps behind. It's on a different path altogether.
That sets up his main argument perfectly, showing that Indian modernity is defined by this dynamic, almost constant clash of conflicting forces.
A clash that is visible everywhere. You see rapid technological growth coexisting with persistent grinding poverty.
And a remarkably resilient democracy that is at the same time strained by rigid social and caste hierarchies.
And then ancient traditions clashing, sometimes violently, with hypermodern global aspirations.
So if we look at the intellectual framework he provides, Jeffrey isn't simply documenting all this complexity.
No, he's offering a new conceptual tool. He argues India provides a new conceptual framework for development in the global South,
positioning the nation not just as a fascinating case study, but as a generator of alternative modernities.
With lessons for the entire world.
Okay, let's unpack the historical bedrock he establishes, starting with the colonial experience. The British legacy is, well, It's a tangle of contradictions.
A huge one. They introduced unifying factors like railways and parliamentary norms, but the system was fundamentally extractive and exploitative.
It deindustrialized India, creating deep economic problems, and, perhaps most damagingly, it exacerbated religious tensions through the infamous divide and rule policy.
And that legacy of exploitation, of deepened communal division, led directly to the foundational trauma that continues to define the region, the partition of 1947. Jeffrey details the horrific defining communal violence and the massive displacement that came with the creation of India and Pakistan. This isn't just history.
No, this trauma continues to shape India-Pakistan relations, military spending, and domestic political rhetoric today.
And the resilience of the political system was soon tested. The deeper question is, how did that system prove to be so durable?
Well, the initial Nehruvian vision was secular and socialist, but the system was critically stressed during the 1975-77 emergency when civil liberties were suspended.
A huge test for a young democracy.
And yet, the subsequent election proved crucial. Despite immense structural challenges, the Indian people overwhelmingly rejected authoritarianism,
which demonstrated a deep, entrenched commitment to democratic principles that, frankly, few at the time believed possible. Moving from politics to the economy, the real watershed moment wasn't independence, but the 1991 reforms.
Right. This was the moment India consciously abandoned the slow-growing, state-controlled system known as the License Raj.
To understand the significance of that, you have to remember the License Raj.
Yeah.
It was just this thicket of bureaucratic regulations and permits for any business activity.
And it led to high levels of corruption, stifled innovation, and resulted in what was called the Hindu rate of growth, a disappointingly slow economic pace.
So abandoning it meant wholeheartedly embracing liberalization and globalization.
The result of that massive philosophical shift is the central economic contradiction of modern India, the two Indias.
Yes. One India is fast-moving and globally connected. It's driven by IT, finance, professional services, and it overwhelmingly benefits urban elites.
And the other India is the vast rural and informal sector, which experiences stagnant agricultural income and a profound lack of quality, secure employment.
This raises a really important question. Why this phenomenon of jobless growth?
Because the sophisticated high-skill service sector is dynamic and creates vast wealth, but it operates with a relatively small number of employees.
Right. It fundamentally doesn't create enough quality, semi-skilled industrial or manufacturing jobs for the millions of young people who enter the workforce every single year.
And that mismatch between education, ambition, and opportunity, that's the engine driving Jeffrey's core concept of time pass.
It's the frustration of millions waiting for the promise of the new economy to materialize, and it creates a massive reservoir of social and political tension.
So to understand where that tension expresses itself, we have to tackle the deep social structures. Jeffrey argues really powerfully that caste is not a relic of the past that is slowly fading away.
No, it's transformed. It has become a key modern political resource.
It's a critical determinant of economic opportunity and, crucially, a primary vehicle for political mobilization.
And this is why it's so central to contemporary politics. You have policies like affirmative action or reservations, which mean the modern state is constantly engaging with caste identity as a mechanism for resource allocation.
Which forces political actors to constantly negotiate and mobilize around caste lines, cementing its modern relevance.
Then you see a stunning gender contradiction.
On one hand, you have women reaching the highest corporate levels, leading major businesses, becoming chief ministers of states.
And yet, India simultaneously struggles with tragically high rates of violence against women and deeply entrenched patriarchal norms that limit opportunities and safety, particularly in rural areas.
And this leads us to the biggest struggle playing out in the political arena, the contested idea of India.
The book describes an ongoing high-stakes battle between the foundational, secular, pluralistic vision, where all religions and identities can flourish, and the powerful ascendant ideology of Hindutva.
Or Hindu nationalism.
Right. Hindutva seeks to define Indian identity in predominantly Hindu cultural and historical terms, shifting the political center of gravity.
And this struggle over national identity is leading to profound political and cultural polarization. It's maybe the biggest internal ideological test the democracy currently faces.
This discussion brings us full circle to Jeffrey's key theoretical contribution, vernacular modernity.
This is the vital concept. Modernization in India is not a simple copy-paste job from the West.
It's the creative adaptation of modern concepts, whether that's democratic institutions, business practices, or even technology, to fit specific local, cultural, and historical contexts.
The economic sphere gives us fantastic examples of this. Indian multinational giants like Tata and Infosys, they didn't just imitate Silicon Valley models wholesale.
No, they blend global standards for efficiency and quality with distinctly local cultural values, long-term familial business ethics, and localized management practices.
Which is a powerful demonstration of how a nation can achieve economic integration without cultural homogenization.
Exactly. And finally, there's India's global presence. Jeffrey characterizes India as a cautious power.
Meaning its foreign policy prioritizes strategic autonomy, so it doesn't align fully with the West or the East, while it simultaneously manages massive regional threats from Pakistan and, increasingly, China.
But its global influence is projected not just through its growing economy and military power, but through significant soft power.
Right. Think of the massive influence of Bollywood cinema, the cultural impact of its widespread diaspora,
and its unparalleled status as the world's largest functioning democracy. This soft power gives it a unique standing on the world stage.
What stands out to me from this entire synthesis is just the necessity of resisting easy generalizations. The overarching paradox is the core message.
So it really is. For every soaring, internationally recognized success, the IT services, the space program, there's a deep internal contradiction.
Destitute farmers, massive infrastructure deficits.
It forces us to appreciate that real-world change, especially in a society of India's scale, is never linear or simple.
And another crucial theme is the youth bulge. This demographic dividend, with over half the population under 25, is unquestionably the primary engine for change.
But, as we discussed, the crisis of underemployment for this educated youth creates a potent source of massive social instability.
The reflection here is powerful. The anxieties of this waiting generation in India serve as a global metaphor for thwarted aspirations wherever economies fail to deliver on the promises made by mass education.
And the third major theme is simply that modernity is not Westernization.
Yes. India offers concrete, functional, alternative models for how a society can modernize while remaining deeply rooted in its own culture.
Its democratic institutions, for example, evolve specifically to accommodate multiple competing interests through constant negotiation. It demonstrates a resilience that consistently defies conventional imported Western theories.
The book's analysis yields some extremely powerful statements that, you know, function as key takeaways. Consider this one on the economy.
India's economic liberalization created two distinct nations within one. A fast-moving, globally integrated India, and a much larger, slower India left stranded in the informal economy. The primary political and social challenge is how to bridge this chasm.
That duality is the root of so many political and social problems.
And on the struggle for identity, Jeffrey states, Indian democracy has defied all odds, but its greatest contemporary test is a battle over its identity. Will it remain a pluralistic nation for all its citizens, or will it be redefined as a Hindu nation?
Which succinctly captures the high ideological stakes of the current political moment. It's nothing less than a battle for the soul of the nation.
And finally, a crucial corrective about society that we really need to internalize.
Mm-hmm.
To understand modern India, one must abandon the idea that caste is a fading tradition. Instead, it has become a modern political resource, a primary vehicle for mobilization, a basis for claiming state resources, and a persistent marker of social and economic hierarchy.
It's essential to realize that caste is modern politics, not just traditional history. So what does this analysis mean for you?
Well, if you're a business leader, an investor, or an entrepreneur, this analysis of the two Indias is vital for risk analysis and market strategy. You can't assume uniformity.
A product or service that succeeds with the urban elite in Mumbai may fail completely in rural Bihar.
Exactly. Understanding regional politics, caste dynamics, labor issues, that's key to navigating things like land acquisition and regulatory complexity.
And for any engaged global citizen, a traveler or a journalist, this is essential contextual intelligence.
It allows you to look at a bustling, seemingly chaotic Indian city and see not just noise and crowds, but the dynamics of rapid, often informal urbanization, labor negotiations, creative local governance.
It elevates your experience far past the superficial tourism narrative to a critical, informed engagement.
And the insight into vernacular modernity offers a universal lesson that applies anywhere in the developing world.
For policymakers and development practitioners everywhere, interventions are infinitely more effective when they build on local cultural resources and institutional norms.
Rather than imposing external one-size-fits-all, imported models that often fail upon arrival.
What resonated most with me is the intellectual paradigm shift Jeffrey demands. We have to move away from viewing India through this linear, Western-centric development lens.
And appreciate it as a unique civilization forging its own hybrid, often messy path.
His combination of academic rigor and deep ethnographic understanding makes immense complexity feel, well, intelligible.
And for me, it's the sheer enduring resilience of Indian democracy, that people, despite facing crushing poverty and inequality, continue to participate in elections in such massive numbers.
Especially when tested, like during the emergency.
Exactly. It shows a deeply rooted, almost visceral commitment to the democratic process itself.
So our final provocative thought for you to mull over: if India's ability to accommodate multiple, sometimes completely contradictory modernities is currently its greatest source of strength,
what happens when the profound economic and social frustrations of its youth, that time-past generation, force a demand for a single, less contradictory, and possibly less inclusive definition of the nation?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.